Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman, and this week with just me, Greg Chapman, presenting the episode because I'm very lucky. It's been a lot of hard work, but I have secured a special treat for you on the podcast this week, and I have arranged an interview at great personal expense, frankly. I have managed to arrange an interview today with the not only incredible historical writer, but also novelist and historical fiction writer, Jem Duducu. Hello, Jem.
I love the way that you very quickly went into that before I said, and Jem Duducu. So that was genius. That was absolutely genius. Thank you so much, Greg.
That's all right. So we are talking about I'm right in saying your first fiction book today.
Yes, correct.
But it is historical fiction. You have sent me a copy to pre-read, and with the summer, I have pre-read some of it before we get started, just so everyone knows where we're starting from. And this is a story certainly starting off in the First World War.
Yes, I mean, I feel that unfortunately, I have to give away a very sort of the part of the character arc, which is what makes it so unique, which is what the feedback is. Oh, that's a good idea. So it's called Silent Crossroads, and it's the fictional story of the only British soldier who fought in both world wars on both sides. So he fights for the British and Germans in World War I. He fights for the British and Germans in World War II, but not necessarily in that order. So that's the basic setup, and everybody who's read it agrees. I come up with legitimate reasons, believable reasons, why somebody would change sides in a world war.
And one question that I had, because I noticed you very quickly from the first synopsis that I heard of the book, you dropped in there the additional word fictional. Because when I first read your account, and it said, and this is something we come back to again and again on the podcast, and you said about the fact that you'd got, it was the account of the only British soldier to fight for both sides in both world wars. One of the first things I did, I must admit, before Googling it, was I did think to myself, well, is this his fictionalized account of a real person, or is this a completely fictionalized story? And I did actually do a quick search for Harry Woods first and make sure that this wasn't a true story that you'd fictionalize. And so that was the first point for me, was just from the synopsis, I wasn't sure whether you were fictionalizing real life or whether you'd made up the story entirely yourself, which you have, really. I mean, obviously, you've worked with your history background and everything else. How difficult was it then trying to make sure that you stayed historical? And have you had anyone else say they thought it was a true story at all yet?
Nobody sort of said it's a true story, but these sound weird comparisons, but I've had people say, "Ooh, it's a little bit like War Horse," and I've had other people say, "Ooh, it's a little bit like Forrest Gump," in the sense that you have a central fictional person who eventually gets married to a fictional woman, but all the events around him are real. And the research, sometimes you might not even realize how real it is. There is a German officer that's very influential throughout most of his life, who's a real guy. And every single battle he's mentioned in, he genuinely was there. So he, I'm not going to say the name of this officer, but he is a real guy who pretty much did everything that's in the book. But obviously, every time he's talking to the fictional character, that didn't happen. And there are a number of real people in these books, in real events. And not just broad brushstroke events like, do you know what? Hitler came to power in Germany in 1933. But, you know, other things that people might not realize, like one of the reasons why I did it this way is, and again, I'm sort of very flattered by this comparison. I've had some people say it's a bit like Saving Private Ryan, in the sense that you have seen a whole bunch of World War II movies, and then the first time you see Saving Private Ryan, it's like, oh my God, I thought I knew World War II until I saw this movie. And So it's just a different way of showing you the same stuff. And that's this point. This is an Englishman who spends the interwar years in Germany. And you realize how awful Germany was in the interwar years. He lives through the hyperinflation. He lives through, there was a civil war in Germany immediately after World War One. So by showing you how awful Germany was, it makes a little bit more sense why in desperate situations you make the wrong choice and you end up following someone like Hitler. Not that Harry ever falls for it, as it were, but he is, you know, you can see it from an outsider's eyes and the unease he has about this situation. But there are members of his own German family who are, you know, avidly thinking that Hitler is going to save Germany, because a lot of people genuinely did in the 1930s. He'd yet to do all the horrible things he was meant to do. That's, if you like, so he's a person who takes you through about 25 years of history, some of the most important history that's ever happened, but you see it through this one person's viewpoint.
I think one of the things it makes me think of, not so much a TV series, but in terms of books, is the Bernard Cornwell Sharp series of books, in that he does a very, very similar thing. He's got an obviously fictionalized character running through the thread that does run into all these real historical situations. And again, you know, it's the same as with yourself. It's the attention to detail. It's the going in. It's making sure that the real people are treated with respect, I think, is the important thing, is that when you bring in the real characters, you're not using them. You're not turning them into something that they're not. If you're using a real person, you are trying to make sure they are a historically accurate representation of that person, and you're trying very hard to be respectful of that real person as well, in a way that you don't have to be if you work purely within fiction. If you work purely within fiction, you can treat any of your characters any way you want. But when you start bringing in real people, did you find that that was at all restrictive? Was there ever a point where you had a real character and you wanted them to do something that they didn't do and you got a bit stuck?
Okay, so there is a real person, again, I'm not going to say who I have changed a fair bit, but their character arc is, particularly the second half of their character arc, is genuinely what they were like. And I know I'm not going to get in any trouble with that individual. Partly because they're dead, but anyway. But actually, going back to that German officer, it took me a long time to find the right German officer, because I needed this guy to have been in a number of different places. And indeed, the only thing I made up was the fact that he was working on security during the Berlin Olympics. Now, there's no evidence of that, but if that's the thing I'm going to change, I don't think anybody's going to get their knickers in a twist over that. But, you know, fighting in World War One, being part of Blitzkrieg in World War II, being part of the Spanish Civil War, all these sorts of things genuinely was involved. So the important stuff's real, the lesser stuff, it doesn't really matter. So it took me a while to find the right person I could do right by, rather than over retconning an individual.
What I don't want to do too much is I don't want to go too much further into the plot of the book, partly because, you know, other people are going to read it, partly because I'm still reading it myself and I don't want too many spoilers coming up ahead. But I know this is something that you want to talk a little bit about, Jim. The fact that, obviously, when you started off writing your history books, I think Busy Person's Guide to British History was your first book.
Yep.
And you self-published that one. And then you went, a few years ago, you actually started to get published with a publishing company for all your 100 facts books. And this one, you've gone back to self-publishing, and I thought you wanted to talk a little bit about why you've decided to go down the self-publishing route with this book rather than just trying to get a, or keeping going until you get a publisher, I think would be the words to you.
Yeah, okay, so the history of this book, I used to, on my Facebook page, I know we've made reference to it in the past, it's actually at History Gems, as if it's a Twitter account on Facebook. It's a mistake I made 5 years ago, and I'm still living with it, okay, everybody? So for a while, once I'd built up a bit of a follower base, as a thank you to people, every 6 months I'd pick three people who clearly contributed a lot on on the page and were nice, but I didn't know anything about them, and I invented history around them. Like, I made them a pirate, and, you know, they were then hung by the British Royal Navy or something like that. And people loved it. The more grisly it was, the better it was. And I had a lot of fun writing them, but I started realizing I started repeating myself. But anyway, for one individual, I said, oh, he was the only man who fought in both world wars on both sides, and blah, blah, blah. And I created this little story, and I had a number of people put underneath it saying, do you know what? That'd be a good idea for a book. So it just stuck in the back of my mind. As I was writing all these history books, in the back of my mind, you know, the thing I originally wrote was like 5 paragraphs long, and it was a little bit flippant. But then the more I was thinking about it, it's like, what would motivate somebody to change sides in the middle of a world war from one side to another side? It really started getting me thinking, and so it sort of it fermented in the back of my head. And then at some point, I just thought, do you know what? I'm ready to write this. And so I wrote it. And what's interesting, Greg, is the bit that you're in at the moment is very early on, he's in a German prison camp. And that was originally 2 pages long. And when I got somebody who are basically my editor of my history books, when I showed it to them, they went, it's way too short. This makes no sense whatsoever. The jump is too quick. So I rewrote the front of that book maybe a dozen times as it got bigger and bigger and bigger and more elaborate. And then eventually I got to the point where I was still getting pushback. I went, look, I have now fleshed this out from like 1,000 words to 10,000 words or 15,000 words. You need to just keep reading because it now makes sense to me, and I've actually written the rest of the book. And then they went, yes, it's great, wonderful. Anyway, I kept getting feedback that was like, this is good. This is genuinely good. I can see this in a bookshop. So I went to my history publisher and said, hey, look at this. This is a new chance. You know, you guys are great at history books, but would you like some historical fiction? They went, that is a completely different market. We are not equipped for that. It's a no. Thank you, but no. I went to a couple of other connections I have in history books, and it was no's from them. And I realized I needed to get to an actual fiction publisher, and the only way you can do that is through representation. You have to have an agent. And so I finished this book 2 years ago, Greg, and it's taken me 2 years of having face-to-face meetings, chasing, having meaningful conversations with agents, and the worst one I hated was I had this particular agent look me in the eye and say, you can write. Okay, tick, quality. People want quality, right? Tick, okay? And they said, this, and this is a commercial idea. Okay, so it's quality and it can sell, because you don't want a book of like esoteric poetry that's really well written, because nobody will buy that. But they then added, but I'm just not in love with it enough to sort of take it on. And I kept getting that. I mean, not exact words to that effect, but I had a number of agents say, it's good, it's quality, but I'm too busy, or it's not quite what I'm looking for now, or I don't know, I'm not in the mood, it's a full moon, etc. And for somebody whose day job is dealing with sales, when somebody throws up an objection, you handle the objection. But they basically mean no, but they do not have the guts to say no. But also they can't tell you why no, because it's a creative thing. And also the standard rejection letters you now get, because people like J.K. Rowling and others have sort of publish their rejection letters, which used to have useful feedback on, they're now wishy-washy. It's like, this is the wrong time for us. We're very busy with our current projects. That doesn't tell me anything. So after a final rejection from somebody who said that they loved the book, then turning around and saying, actually, I don't like this book. It's like, what? How can you have changed your opinion on this book just because we're now actually going to have a meeting about it? At that point, I went, okay, enough's enough. I'm going to self-publish. I am going to take control of this book project again. And no, it clearly will not sell as much as a Frederick Forsyth or something like that. But at least there will be hopefully people who listen to this podcast, you know, look at my history book page on Facebook, and hopefully hundreds of people read it, and there'll be enough people out there who go, do you know what? This is really good. I don't know why this didn't get properly published. This is really good. And that's what I'm looking for now.
I think it's really interesting to me from that point of view where you talk about the creativity and the sales pushback particularly, because the basic idea, as I understand it, is, you know, they're doing sales, and if somebody says to you, oh no, that's too big, you say to them, I don't know, ah, but you've got a space for it or something, you know.
Yeah, I'll make it smaller for you. That's too expensive. Okay, well, let's look at the cheaper option, or let's negotiate on the price. You know, there are ways round problems, but they didn't want to find the ways.
And obviously, you know, it's one of those things where you're now, you know, you've almost slipped into what I consider to be more my territory of sales, that of trying to sell a creative thing. If I try and sell somebody one of my shows and they turn around and say, oh, that's, you know, that's too expensive, we can't afford that, we haven't got the budget for that or whatever, then I can negotiate on price. You know, that's one of the things I can do, or I can say, ah, but, you know, it's adding this extra value, or anything else that I'm kind of going to try and work with to try and, you know, sell the show. But most of the time, because I'm in a creative field, what people will turn around and say is, I don't think that act really fits in the overall scheme of the show. And, you know, it's not saying anything against the show. It's not making any specific point about why it's not. And you end up with that same thing with the book, you know, creatively, it's just not right for us. And I know I have to do the same thing to other people. You know, I've just been sorting out some new posters to go on my my mobile stage bike. And I had to look through a few people, and a few people sent me sort of proposals and things when I was feeling out the job. And you sit there and you go, okay, I like that one, I'm going to go with this person. And you can't necessarily put your finger on why when you're working in the creative thing. And it's not a question of, oh, if that person halves their price or something, I'll go with them instead, because that's not what it is. But it is incredibly frustrating when you're the one trying to sell whatever it is, because people will come up to you and they say, oh, really like your show, really enjoyed that, really like that. Same thing with the book. And then you get down to the point, oh, brilliant. Well, would you actually like to, you know, take it on? Would you? And they say, no, because it's just not right for us. And it's that, rejection of it's not right for us, that it's really impossible to do any sort of pushback against. You're then just stuck. So I can see from that point of view how, you know, for me, that has been the last, 15 years really of my life, has been getting the rejection of, you're just not quite right. You know, it doesn't quite. But, you know, luckily with enough interspersed people saying, oh no, actually, you're spot on what we need. Here you go. Come and juggle for us and we'll give you some money. You know, that's basically how it works.
But the podcast has now degenerated into Jem and Greg's self-therapy.
Well, yes, indeed it has. But my point is, overall, that eventually I did the same thing that you did. I originally started out working as an actor, and I tried to get into other people's shows. And eventually what I did is the same thing, basically, that you do by going self-published. And I said, okay, fine. If, you know, you won't let me play with your ball, I'll go and start my own game. That's essentially the sort of way you're working. So,
In essence, yes. But I just wanted to say that the there's an even bigger story behind this, but I'm not going to bore people to tears. But with one of those people who said, look, it just isn't quite my thing, but I really like it. I really like you, and I really like her. So I actually ended up writing another book. We're not going to go into that one now. I actually wrote an entire new book for this person, submitted it to them. They went, oh, it's set in the Middle Ages. I don't like the Middle Ages. What? I have just written 110,000 words and got it professionally edited, and you can't even be bothered to read it because it's not the time frame. It was breathtaking, that particular response. But anyway, putting all that to one side, you know, look, I went freelance nearly 3 years ago. If that didn't work, I have a family. I have a mortgage. That would be a serious, serious problem. But instead, touch wood, things are going well in my freelance training work. Really, when it comes to the history, I've monetized my hobby. It certainly doesn't pay the bills or anything. But so I've succeeded in a career. I've succeeded in setting up my own freelance work. I've succeeded in having a beautiful family and a beautiful wife. And, you know, I'm healthy and all these things. You know, if the worst thing I can say is I was unable to get a literary agent and not get my book properly published, I'm a winner. I'm a huge winner in life. What a, you know, if that's the worst thing I can say, I'm happy. I'm really happy. So, you know, let's all put this into context. First world problems and all that. You know, I'm thank you, Amazon, for allowing me to publish this. And also, I had a friend who's so in love with the book. He got me in with a design agency. That's Greenwich Design, people in Greenwich, London. They're brilliant. Love them. But the owner of Greenwich Design read the book and said, I love this. Oh, he's going to self-publish? We'll do the front cover for free. I actually went for a briefing. They had 11 different designs for me, with a designer sitting there scribbling away on my feedback notes. And, you know, and I'm getting that service for free. I had more fun getting the front cover of this book done than any of my actual published history books, where basically my publisher says, this is what the front cover's going to be. Unless you got any serious problems about the historical accuracy of it, it's this. I had loads more fun with this. So yes, it was frustrating, but actually this has been more enjoyable than any of my history books doing it. And part of it is also I can make stuff up in the book as well, whereas I can't do that in a history book. You tend to get in trouble when you do that in a history.
Oh, that's where I've been going wrong. Yeah. But yeah, I was going to come up to the subject of the front cover designs, actually, because I know you emailed those out earlier in the week. You sent out an email to me and a few other people I know with these book front cover designs. And I thought this is very different. I know that the last time Jem wrote a book, he's, you know, you often send me a copy in advance to have a read through because we know we're going to do a little bit of an interview about it. You know, just have, but this one, because you're self-published, you very much, you emailed me, said, could you read this through? Can you give me criticisms? Can you give me your thoughts? Can you give me, and then, you know, a few weeks later, you send through these covers. And I thought, this is a very, very different style. You've now, it's that thing with self-published where I think part of the problem with the word self-published is it's become a series of different categories at this point in time. You get self-published, which means I will scribble something incredibly quickly and I'll shove it up on Amazon, you know, because you can. It's incredibly simple nowadays. And you get things that just make absolutely no sense and are, you know, real, should we call them vanity projects?
Absolutely. Or people who can write but don't bother getting it edited or think that they can do the editing themselves. But you really do have to know your grammar. You really do have to know your flow. And also, if you're reading what you've written, you skim bits and you cannot do that as an editor. Whereas my history book editor has been through this. And in fact, she loves it so much. She's probably now read it 12 times, which is more than she ever does with any of my history books. And, you know, she started asking me queries, really deep diving. And it's like, well, the German family, you say that their home is above the shop, but you also say the dad's office is above the shop. That can't possibly be right. It's like, wow, I didn't know that. And I wrote it. Okay. You know, so she's done such a deep dive. You know, she's querying the publisher, the writer, and now knows more than I do about my own story. But if you like, because we keep talking about the war bits and, you know, we've talked about the history elements of it. But this, you know, one of the things about the front covers was some of these are just way too militaristic. This is not All Quiet on the Western Front. This is not Saving Private Ryan. This is, yes, he is a soldier. There are battle scenes in it, and it's there to show you the horrors of mechanized warfare and how this guy just really doesn't want to be there, but just happens to be there. But it's very much a love story. You know, the key reason why he changes sides in World War One is for love. And in the interwar years, he gets married and he has a daughter. And very much in the Second World War stage of it, it's all it is just about him wanting to get back to his wife and his daughter. And the wife and daughter, as they mature throughout the books, the story, I should say, you know, we learn more and more about them. And, you know, they're in Germany during World War Two. They get bombed by the RAF, you know, so you know, they're in just as much danger as Harry is. And, you know, the daughter, because of her age, she has to join the Hitler Youth. And so now there's a whole other danger about, is this is this lovely girl going to be indoctrinated by the Nazis and the mother's struggle for the daughter's soul? So, yes, I'm so sorry I'm telling you stuff that's happening later on in the book, but what I want to say is this is not a boy's own story. This is not Saving Private Ryan in and of itself. There is absolutely sort of like the action there and the sort of like the male stuff for the guys, but it's all hung on, you know, well-written characters in believable relationships. And the feedback from women is, you know, just, do you know what? Sometimes I've skimmed through a couple of the tank battles, but I love the stuff with the daughter and the mother. And, you know, that really, you know, speaks to me as, you know, if you think about it, you know, Harry in the first scenes, he's 17 years old on the Western Front, you know, and by the time he's, you know, at the end of this book, he's my age. You know, we've seen him and the wife and the daughter mature over the books. So there's huge amounts of character development, not just in terms of events happening in history, but in terms of how people change over the years as well.
I'm going to leap into that point, and then I'm going to just leap back to the other point about the publishing, which is, I think one of the first things I actually said to you when I started to read the book was about the action sequences. Yes, the book is a romance. You know, I'm going to kind of take the opposite point from you here as well, because it is a romance book. There is, it's not all just go, go, go adventure. But what I did say to you was, when you get to those action sequences, when you get to the battles, you've managed to do a really good job of keeping it dramatic and exciting and fast moving, but also at the same time, keeping it at a very, very personal level.
Thank you.
It's not like a lot of books do, and a lot of especially Hollywood films. I mean, that opening scene of Saving Private Ryan, as we've mentioned that a couple of times, where it is all just fast cuts, see this, see that, until you can very quickly get very confused. And a lot of books do the same thing. They're dashing around the back. They're starting to get very, very confused. Whereas with your one, I found you managed to keep that pace up, that adventure and excitement, but at no point in time was I ever confused about what was going on. I knew where Harry was and I knew what was happening throughout the battle. And I think that with a lot of adventure writing, that is a crucial balance to keep up. And so I think that's something you did very, very well. So although it's not a boy's own adventure story, when you do get to the action sequences, those are every bit as good as the romantic bits, as the quieter, the softer bits that fit in between the lines.
Oh, thank
and as
you
say, it is the development of character as well. Before I, you know, make you blush too much, I'll hop back to the because people can feel the blush through the radio at this point in time. My point about the publishing, yes. So you've got those people that dash out. You know, they get a book, they get it up online. Let's call that the condensed histories route to publishing a book. But this, even sort of your busy person's guide, that probably the first time you did self-publish, you know, you're coming, now you've been through the publishing process with professional publishers, with your history books. This feels less like self-publishing. I say self-publishing, it used to be called vanity publishing. I think that was, you know, one of the other words for it. I may be wrong. That may be slightly different.
What happened kind of before the era of the Kindle and Amazon is what you would do is somebody would tell you would submit something to these small companies, these vanity publishers. I actually sort of, I didn't fall for this in the sense of I went through it, but when I was being researching, I spoke to this company and I realized, oh, they're one of those. Where basically they turn around, they say nothing but great things about your book and then say, we're going to charge you for costs, basically, about £2,000, and we will give you 100 copies of the book. So now you have to sell it yourself or just give it to your friends. And it's all very professionally done. But the point is, it doesn't cost £2,000 to print 100 books. You know, the only reason why you're not going to make any money from that. So it is, of course, pure vanity. You can pretend that it's as well circulated as a Harry Potter book or something. But of course, it isn't. But nowadays, yeah, I mean, there have been some huge hits from self-publishing, the whatever you may think of them, but the 50 Shades of Grey are a series of self-published books. I think they were eventually picked up. Let's talk about something a bit better, The Martian, which got turned into a big Hollywood movie as well. That was also, that also started as a self-published book that then publishers... This seems to be a new way of attracting attention from publishers. When people see the actual finished product on Amazon, go, that's good, then it gets taken down and then gets republished by an actual publisher. So, and I'd be happy to do that if any of them ever listen to this and like what I've written. But yeah, so it, so Amazon have changed the rules over the last 10 years.
And I think that, so you've got that sort of line, but I think we need to distinguish between people who are self-published and who publish themselves. Because when, when I did my books, I definitely self-published, you know, I did everything myself, but I kept it very much, and this is something I'm working on when I do get the next book out, this is something I'll be a bit more careful about. I will make sure that once I finish writing the book, I then step back from it and I treat it a bit more, I suppose coldly is probably the word, but as a publisher. And that's what I feel that, you know, you're doing at this point in time. You wrote the book, you then sent it to editors, you've listened to the editors, you've not got pressures about the book, you've, you know, you've sent out, when you do the front cover designs, you've sent them out for other people's opinions. You've done sort of the focus group, sort of probably the sales training is coming in there. You've done the focus group thing, you've checked what people think of the designs. You are not just self-publishing, you're not just going for it on your own, one-man band, let's see how... You are very definitely, you've got this book, and now you've switched from being the author of that book to being the publisher of that book, and you're now publishing it, and you're doing that strictly as a publisher and taking the author side sort of slightly out of it to make sure it is now published properly.
I think that's fair. Yes, absolutely. And what occurred to me once I started getting involved in publishing books, yeah, actually having them published by Ambly Publishing, the history books, is how many people are who are involved in it. You know, when you pick up a book in a bookshop, you think, oh, it's written by X. This is all X's work. No, it isn't. You know, you've got a designer of the front cover. You've got an editor behind it. You've probably got, you know, a number of people casting their eye over it. And yes, having conversations with those literary agents led to me changing bits in the opening of the book. So the thing that I'd already rewritten about a dozen times got rewritten about 5 or 6 more times on top of that. And then when it finally went back to being self-published, I have jinxed around with it a little again. I think there are, you know, probably 3 legitimate ways you could open up this book. But once you're kind of in the trenches with Harry, sort of once you're 20 pages into it, after that, I stand by what's there. That really hasn't changed too much over the many iterations of this book, because in the words of my editor, goes, look, this covers there are a lot of characters, this covers a long period of time, but there's no waffle in this, there's no fat, every scene is there for a reason. I really took that as a compliment, because yeah, the amount of times I've read books where you get 3 paragraphs of how the character moved from one area to another area, where they walked down the hill, it was a sunny day, la 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 la, you can argue that that's setting up, you know, a feeling or whatever, but if there's no payoff to it, it's just padding. And sometimes there are, you know, very fat books where there are very fat bits in it which could be cut out. This is about 120,000 words long, which is, you know, it's a little bit longer than your average novel, but only a little bit. It's certainly not Lord of the Rings. And when you consider that it does encapsulate about 25 years worth of time, you know, things jinx along pretty quickly.
And we've pretty much run out of time. So what, by the time this episode does come out, this book will be available on Amazon, won't it?
Correct, yes.
Silent Crossroads. And of course, the easiest way to find it, you don't have to even remember the name. If you go to condensedhistories.com/gems, you can follow the link straight from there to get the book. And what that actually does is that will give us a double whammy, actually. That will allow you to buy the book. It won't cost you anything extra to buy the book going through that way. But Amazon actually gives us a little bit of extra money on top of that in order to keep supporting the podcast and we can keep calling you. Now, I know that loads and loads of people are going to be listening to this, going out, getting copies of this book. Please make sure you do it. And I won't leave Jem to push his book too much. What I will say at this point in time is buy it now if you're thinking about buying it. If you're thinking, I can't read it for a couple of weeks, the first week or two of a new book releasing on Amazon is really, really crucial to sort of getting it up the book charts, the book listings and everything else. It's how quickly that book starts to sell. So even if you're thinking you might not get a chance to read it for a couple of weeks, now is a fabulous time to get onto Amazon and make sure you
and
get your
reviews as well. That's also really important. With my history books, I could always do with a few more reviews, guys. If you've read any of my history books and haven't put a review on Amazon, please do so. It always helps. But particularly when, as you know, as Greg's pointed out, with the self-publishing stuff, there's so much stuff out there. Some of it is brilliant. Some of it gets turned into movies. But a lot of it is poorly edited, and it's, you know, a rather amateurish, but, you know, the heart's in it type production. And people may be worried about that with this book. They might think it's sort of badly edited, poor, you know, crass, etc. You know, this is as close as you can get to a published book in the self-publishing arena, he said modestly. But, you know, design studios, editors have been involved in this book. People don't know that unless it's put in a review. So if you want to say it's a great book, lovely, but you might want to say the quality is there. That would be very, very useful. Thank you, guys.
And that's just about it from us for today. So please, Silent Crossroads by Jem Deduccio. As Jem said, leaving a review really helps. And just so you know, there is no harm in mentioning in your review that you listen to the Condensed History Gems podcast, which Jem co-hosts. But most importantly, please do, at the very least, head over to Amazon and check out the book. See if you like the description of it. If you like what we've been talking about, I have been reading the book. I've still got the rest of it to finish by the time this comes out. I will have finished it. I will be getting my review up on Amazon as well as soon as I can. But for now, thank you so much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deduccio.
And thank you very much to my interviewer, Greg Chapman.
And that is all we've got time for. So just thank you to all of you for listening. We will be back with more history once again next week. But for now, goodbye and take care.